Good evening. You're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia. It's Wednesday, the 16th of September, 2009. Welcome back to the show. Tonight, we have some really amazing stuff lined up for you. For the next half hour, I've got John Bursell on the line, and we're going to be covering the latest news on the anniversary of September 11. And we've got quite a few things to get through there. And then in the in about half an hour's time, I've got a very special story, and again, something new for Truth News. That's the story of Chappelle Corby and miscarriage of justice. So I've come to understand, and that comes from a very close member of the Corby family, who's going to be on the line telling us the information, the key information that you need to know on that topic, which probably hasn't come up through the mainstream news. So that's extremely important. Now, look, we've got a lot to get through, so I'd just like to move right ahead and start off by welcoming John Bursell to the show. John.
G'day, Harold. How are you?
I am superb. Just running a bit against time at the moment. I had a lot to organise today. Look, we've got to talk about September 11, and I just want to start by recapping on the anniversary of September 11 and what happened here in Sydney. So I'll just give us a little sting here to get us on our way. Okay, well, beginning the show tonight with September 11. And John, would you like to just give a recap for how you felt about our anniversary of September 11 here in Australia and what we've been able to achieve and what you think we possibly achieved in Sydney this last week?
Well, I think it was a really good year this year for 9/11 Truth. It started a bit slow after the election of Barack Obama and also the changing of government here. There was a little bit of a lull. But coming into the early part of the year, obviously, we had the Thematic Material paper came out that really gave us some clear forensic evidence that still, even though it's been disputed, the chain of custody, really that argument doesn't make any sense. So I think basically we've got a hard piece of forensic evidence that is without any sort of critical comment against it. And building from that point on, it just seems that the 11th day of every month protest, the We Are Change groups, everything just is continually building at a very slow, gradual pace, but in a way that gives me a lot of confidence that we will continue to move forward. And just talking to Janice Matthews at 911truth.org and quite a few other people in the movement over the last few days, the hit rates on the sites were way up again, getting back to what they were in 2006, you know, when a lot of people said that we'd peaked as a movement. I think the evidence now shows that we've consolidated. We're stepping up again. This Charlie Sheen thing is bringing it back to the consciousness of the mainstream. And, you know, every time these editors of these magazines, the editors of these newspapers continue to attack people like Charlie Sheen, they're directly attacking the family members, the victims of 9/11. They're showing themselves to be weasels, to be scum, to be, you know, lower than the perpetrators themselves by maintaining their egotistical "we know better than you" attitude when the evidence is completely contrary to the official view of 9/11. And, you know, I think it's putting us in a very powerful position. At the ABC, I think the main aim there, I think if you had to stand back and look at it, we're subverting the power of the ABC. We're subverting the power of the government with truth. And I think that's the way to a free and just world.
Yeah, look, you know, we're doing what we can in Australia. I mean, we've got smaller numbers here than obviously they can roll out onto the streets in the US. I mean, New York had a large protest. I still don't know what the number is, but I saw some of the video coverage from some news sources, Russia Today did coverage.
Many thousands, I'm not sure how many, but you know, it's 20 million people in New York City, I believe, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, 20 million in New York, indeed, yeah.
So, you know, we had about, 35 people out during the day, and, if we were in New York, if we were in a similar-sized city to New York, we probably would have had a few hundred. But obviously, the people aren't so close to the sentiment as they are in New York. In Sydney, a lot of those people, know people that are dying.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, are you there, John? Okay. We seem to have lost John. I'll just pause while we see what happened to him. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, we've got John back, having a few problems as usual tonight. Thanks for that quick wrap-up there of events. I guess I should point out, just in case people listening aren't familiar with the Charlie Sheen event, there was a major, campaign that Charlie Sheen has launched in association with InfoWars and Alex Jones. And there's various videos and actually quite an excellent interview that was done between Alex Jones and Charlie Sheen and
Bob McElvain,
yeah, from the victims' families. And we'll post some of that on the site so you can download it.
Are we going to talk a little bit about what Sheen's done and a few of the hit pieces against him?
Yeah, look, let's just give a quick recap on that. I mean, of course, Charlie Sheen is an actor. He's not the world's most sort of best example of humanity or whatever. He's a guy who's had a colourful life and he's done a lot of things. And of course that's used against him and has been in the past, so any mistakes he's made or whatever excesses of behavior, obviously that counts against him. Facts that he, saw prostitutes or whatever has been brought up. But as I see it, I mean, I was a bit pessimistic at the beginning when I saw what he'd done and I had some, criticisms of it. But I still think it's probably, I mean, we really need more people. He's already stepped up before, but since he's the only one, we just have to really applaud him and we have to really just say what a great guy,
Absolutely. And some of the criticisms that were made early on with the letter was the fact, that it was a bit sensational. It was a bit of a stunt. But obviously that's the nature of media and it worked. So then the backing up with that interview that you had up at 911oz.com I'd sent out, and a lot of people were very, very impressed with that interview. Charlie Sheen playing it very simple, using 20 key points. One or two of them I don't think particularly are strong, but they are very easy to understand, and they're things that are on the public record and things that people are aware of. They can easily find out, easily verifiable, and we know that he picked the right points because they haven't been used against him in the media. All that's been used against him in the media is the fact that from those points, it's pointing the finger at elements of the American government. From those points, but that's not what Charlie Sheen's doing. But because he's done such a good job at presenting evidence, now that they're now accusing him of saying that the Bush government was responsible for 9/11 because of the evidence.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So this is the ridiculous nature of what's going on out there. But that interview, bringing in Bob McElvain, who some people might have thought a bit strange that Bob sort of said he didn't really care who's supporting him in the campaign. Really, didn't give Charlie Sheen maybe the worshipping that some people might have, because he doesn't care who Charlie Sheen is. He just cares that someone's helping. And that was really good. I thought that really drove home the point that this is a matter of justice, of closure for the victims of 9/11. And Charlie Sheen's just acting as a person. And the only reason he's acting and able to get the media that he's getting is because of his involvement with television, the thing that's put forward the myth. And it's so ironic that we have the number one paid television actor standing up and pushing back against the machine, just like Jonathan and Rollerball, if you're aware of that movie for the old movie buffs.
Right.
And this is just an absolutely it's a, like a sort of a sci-fi anti 1984 moment, you know, like it's just a really good thing for a lot of people that still see hope, you know.
Well, yeah, and I think it's really important, and you know, it's a fact that I wasn't aware of that he, until recently, until last week, I didn't realize he had become that important in television. I think 3 years ago when he first came out, I don't think his television show had reached that stage yet. So he's become much more powerful as a media celebrity from this television fame. So,
absolutely.
So
he will cost, if they sack him over this, he will cost them millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So that gives him some power, and that's true. But anyway, it's just an amazing way that he's done it. He's kept it very simple. He's made sure he's got the support of the family members. He's gone in there in a very big way. Now, obviously, the Alex Jones thing, some people like him, some people don't. The simple fact is that he can get the wave out, or he can get the information out to more people than anyone else quickly. And that's what's important about these things. So it's a platform, and people just need to remember that that's a platform. You don't have to agree with the person that provides it necessarily, but it's there, and you know, it's being used. Now, one of the hit pieces I saw, Harold, I think you said that you had, not Hereford like we got last week, Harold. What
right.
About getting called Harold?
Yeah, look, it happens from time to time. Yeah, yeah.
It's an unusual name, but it's
I roll
it's
with
a noble name, I believe, anyway. So we've got Charlie Sheen getting attacked in the Guardian, the Telegraph in the UK, telegraph.co.uk. And this is one of the hit pieces that I like the most, because the picture is of Charlie Sheen being arrested by the police up against the car with the cuffs on, and that's sending a subliminal message. This is what's going to happen to you if you stand up against us.
That's interesting, isn't it?
You know, an obviously authoritarian thing to do from this bloody journalist, you know, this young sort of 30-year-old idiot, you know, that decides he wants to take on Charlie Sheen and the victims' families of 9/11. He puts up this picture of Sheen getting arrested, and the caption is, "Charlie Sheen being arrested for his dangerous free thinking." Now, it's sort of Orwellian. It's like they're sort of teasing us with it.
That's amazing. Well, do you know where the image was sourced from? I mean, was it from a television?
It's from one of it. This is what goes on, or possibly just starring in the film The Chase. You know?
Okay, so it's actually from a film.
You know, that's a subliminal message to the populace, isn't it?
That's
no
very strong.
That
is very, very strong. It's almost psyop.
He's sweaty. He looks like he's on drugs. Anyway, you know, it was very suggestive. But anyway, it goes down, and he's making the case that it's all about ego. You know, and one of the paragraphs here in the comments are just so strong against this guy. It's just unbelievable. These people are committing media suicide. They don't even seem to care. So who's paying them? That's what I want to know. It's not the readers. Anyway,
amazing.
I suspect that the reason 9/11 is particularly attractive to conspiracy theorists, we've heard that time and time again, is that it happened while President Bush was in power. Most conspiracy theorists that I've come across despise Bush. Although their ideas about him are somewhat confused, on the one hand, they think he's sick, but on the other hand, they think he's clever enough to oversee a plot as complicated as faking the biggest terror attack in American history. At any rate, believing in outlandish conspiracy theories is exciting. It makes you feel smart and superior and important. It gives you a thrilling boost to the ego, a bit like being a Hollywood star.
Okay.
Stuff, garbage, you know.
It is.
The disrespect for the people the families and the victims and the people that have suffered, the millions that have died. You know, it's disgusting. Anyway, this other bit, you're going to love this bit, because we've seen these theories come up. You know, that's why I didn't want to do the moon landing episode, but we did it, and I think it was valuable. But anyway, disappointingly, Sheen is yet to confirm that Osama bin Laden recorded his anti-West videos in the same filter as the Americans used to fake the moon landings. Perhaps Sheen can also supply us with proof that Bush faked 7/7. So he drops that one in there as well. So, you know, these things are, it's only a short article, but the whole thing is crafted to hit on all the buttons that they seem to be regurgitating in this mantra. It's like a mantra.
That is like a textbook example of a media disinformation hit piece. So that's really important. We'll put that up on the show.
Put it on the show notes. You'll dig it. Yeah. I'll send it through to you. Great. Actually, I'm going to send it out to my list.
Send that through to us, and we'll put it up.
Good.
Okay. Look, I've got to cover a couple more things over the next 15 minutes. So let me just take a quick break here. I really want to alert our listeners to brand new website, amazing website that we've created for the new conference coming up in November called The Hard Evidence. It's www.thehardevidence.com, developed by a local Sydney developer here who's been working with us, Sasha, and that website is now up with all the information, and you can go there and you can buy a ticket to this amazing conference. It's got Richard Gage, Stephen Jones, John Burstall, and even I make a small appearance in the conference. This is like the most important scientific evidence that you're going to find in the 9/11 Truth Movement from the people who authored that and the people who are responsible for really bringing this to the general public. So really great opportunity now to get there and get a ticket, because it probably will get sold out. So I'd say...
Well, we sold about 65 tickets in the sort of first week. Compared that to the last time we did a conference, that's really quite promising. Most people think it's going to sell out on that basis. So,
excellent.
Yeah, get in there and get your tickets. The afternoon panel, there's a press release up at that site too. If you select the press, you can copy and paste the press release. You'll see that the panel of experts that we've gathered for that afternoon session, people like Dr. Frank Legg, people like Dr. David Leifer from Sydney University, Paul Mason, structural engineer, building inspector for the government.
Right.
This is a hardcore panel. And Luke Radowski is going to be there representing the people of New York. He deals with every day the first responders. He knows the firemen that heard the explosions, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Very, very powerful. Hopefully we're going to have William Rodriguez there. We're working on a sponsor at the moment.
Speaking of Luke Radowski, I just want to put the call out here on the radio show. We are looking for a sponsor for Luke Radowski. And what's the kind of money we're looking for to cover Luke's cost?
At the moment, the airfares, if someone comes in soon, the airfares are around $1,000 US.
Okay.
Approximately, and there'll be some incidental costs, and we want to make sure he's looked after. So I'm setting a figure of 2,000 Australian dollars, which equates to about 1,500 US. That should see him here looked after, and he's got, he's staying in my house, so we're doing everything very cheaply. But that's the sort of money we need to get Luke out here. So if people want to do I've got numerous part sponsors. Some people have put up $1,000. I've got two sponsors for Richard Gage, $1,000 each. I've got sponsors for Jones, sponsors for Matthews, Janice Matthews, director of 911truth.org. This is the best group of people ever seen in a conference in the world. It is the best. In Australia, in Sydney, the heart of the New World Order. We're going to be right there in the heart of the city. Please get on board. What an honour to sponsor Luke Radowski, who's got in the face of David Rockefeller. Some people say he runs the world. Got in his face and asked him tough questions. What a guy.
Yeah, and of course, Luke is the founder of WeAreChange.org. We've got WeAreChange.org.au, which is closely connected to Truth News. And we've been trying to build up We Are Change here with film nights, and having Luke here will be great. It'll really give some people, I think, an incentive to do more, because we would like to see We Are Change take off here. I'd really like to see people putting their hand up to do spontaneous things. I've been able to do as much as I can, which is...
Well, the 11th Day Action that week will have Luke Radowski, Cosmos, from truthaction.org, the person that came up with the idea for the 11th of every month, that is compiling a history of this movement, of every photo, of every video there is around the world of what we're doing to prove to people that we're not going to give up. So that, the idea is to reduce the amount of time by demonstrating worldwide what we're up to, so people can get the idea that we might have a chance of winning. We need to get out there on the street. These people are coming. We're going to put on an action at the ABC. Luke Radowski, no doubt, will be filming it. What better grip could you have on a truth action than Luke Radowski? We've got Janice Matthews, director of 911truth.org. Hopefully we'll get Jones and Gage if they get in early enough to come to this protest leading up to this event. It's just going to be unbelievable. Luke will be doing some sort of truth squad on someone while he's here. Who knows who it is? He said he's researching it at the moment. That's going to be exciting. Obviously, we're doing a three-camera professional shoot in a theatre. I've got 26 people in the team helping us on the 2 days. It's costing up. Getting close to $40,000. The tickets are going to make us 20 if we're lucky. So this is money that people are just getting out of their pockets and supporting. We need some help from people out there. Whatever you can give, go to thehardevidence.com. You can contact me on the email. Put up some money. Let's get some money into the sponsorship. If we can't find the money, I'm going to be paying it out of my pocket, and this will be my last event. There's absolutely no way I'm doing another event. If I lose, I've allowed myself $5,000 to lose, but if I lose 10, I'm out.
Okay. That's a really good call to action there. And look, this is a moment now to increase awareness in Australia. I just wanted to say this. I fully understand why it is that we can't get the numbers in Sydney, but I still wish in my heart of hearts that we could. And I'd just like people to understand the importance of getting out on the street. In addition to all the other things that you can do, writing letters and, you know, getting involved in any kind of like websites or forums or all those things, that they're great. But when you get out on the street, once the numbers get above a critical threshold, for example, last week at the ABC, I think if we'd had 100 people outside the ABC, there's a chance they would have brought a camera crew down and filmed it. I mean, it's very simple. When you get above a certain number, it's treated as news. And they just treat it as news. It's not, there's no magic about it. It's just, if you have a large number of people standing outside a building, it suddenly becomes a news story. Now, I think we should be able to get 100 people. I think we should be able to get more than that. But I think sometimes people don't understand the importance of it. Just the importance, and you don't have to do anything. Just turn up. It becomes news. So, you know, we
actually had a really effective team. We had all the exits covered. We gave out thousands and thousands of flyers. We were talking to journalists. We were abused by some journalists. Two of the comments that ring home to me were two ladies, baby boomers in their mid-50s, that one of them walked straight at me, nearly tried to run over me. She was that angry that I was there. Haven't you got something better to do, she was saying. And then another lady said, oh, 9/11, so 10 years ago, in this posh North Shore accent. You know, these people are getting called out and they're getting pissed off, and that's great. That's what we're going to do. And we're subverting the media control at the ABC, because the young journalists, I'm talking to a guy from the 7:30 report, I'm talking to a guy from the news desk, numerous other people had conversations with journalists. I've seen them on film. And we delivered the Thermitic material papers. We had the best evidence. We had Blueprint for Truth. We had the Thermitic material lecture from Stephen Jones. We had Blues Chain's Final Cut, which is a real solid piece. And we had William Rodriguez's testimony, his full two-hour version of his story, backed up by all the witnesses. Mate, you know, it can't get any better than that. The information we've got's awesome. But like Harewood said, if we had 100 people there, we wouldn't have just had people handing stuff out. We would have had a presence, a real presence. And we were getting cheers. I went home and I felt a true inner peace in myself about that I'd done the right thing, and I felt cleansed, you know, by doing that, by standing up to these people.
Yeah, that's exactly what we have to do. On that note, I think we're going to have to move on now to the next section of the show. So I'm just going to give you something to listen to here while we organise to get our next guest on the show.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin and half-truths? Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Okay, we are back with the second half of tonight's show, and a really, really important broadcast for us. We haven't got into this territory before. It's very relevant to Australia, and you know, we like to, on Truth News, cover stories that are really important for our country, our people, and I'm lucky enough to have been able to make contact with Roy Reeves, who is a close family member of the Corby family, that as in Chappelle Corby, who was imprisoned in Bali several years ago. And Roy came to my attention actually as a result of a conference that John Bursell and Roy both attended in Brisbane a couple of weeks ago. And I'll just read to you here some information that that I've been provided. This is from Roy. My wife and I have known the Corby family for 20 years when our son and the Corby kids were at school together. Our son died 11 years ago, just after we had moved into the country, and for a while our link with the Corby family was broken. Chappelle's arrest and subsequent imprisonment and my decision to become an active supporter rekindled the bond between our families. Reading her book, My Story, was a profoundly moving and life-changing event. The day I closed the back cover, I wrote to Chappelle pledging my support for as long as it takes. I consider myself a man of honour as well as a very loyal friend. And since that day, I have lived and breathed Chappelle Corby practically 24/7. I am now a very close friend of the family and part of a small and trusted group of supporters who are regarded as Chappelle's strongest advocates. Now, I just want to say, like, the point of what we're doing tonight here is to share the information. It's not up to me or anyone here tonight to adjudicate, and I'm not well enough abreast of all the information in the case to know exactly what I think. But I think it's very important because I think that there hasn't been enough proper coverage of this story in Australia. And what we have seen is a media smear campaign that I think was clearly proven to be that by the way it was treated, with Channel 7 running a very, very biased and just, incorrect piece of news on the Chappelle Corby's family. So having said all that, I'd just like to now welcome to the show Roy Reeves.
Hello.
Hello and welcome to Truth News.
Thank you.
And we've also got John standing in on the second half of the show. John is actually quite well-versed in a lot of issues around airport security. So, John, are you there?
I am. I've got a little bit of trouble hearing Roy.
Okay, yeah, actually, you're coming through a little bit weak, Roy. I don't know if it's maybe you need to get a bit closer to your microphone or if you can turn your volume up. I'm getting quite good levels from John, but yours is a bit low. So maybe if you could just lean a little closer to your mic.
Yeah, how's this?
That's much better. Much better, yeah.
Okay.
So look, Roy, I mean, I've tried there to give a bit of an introduction to you. I'd just like to basically hand it over to you to convey in the way you wish what it is you're doing. And I guess, you know, the most really concise evidence that you can present to the Australian public that that there's been a miscarriage of justice, because I think that's what really this hangs on.
Yeah, well, firstly, I should point out that I am a friend of the family, not a family member. But I have known the Corby family for nearly 20 years, as you said in your introduction. Our son, who now is dead, unfortunately, and the Corby kids went to school together, and he was a friend of the Corbys. But basically, I suppose after reading her book, I mean, I was supportive of Chappelle from day one because there's no way in the world that I thought she was guilty. And when I did eventually get round to reading her book, which I admit I probably should have done a little earlier than I did, it moved me so much that I just felt the need to do what I possibly could to ensure that Chappelle came home as quickly as possible, because there has indeed been a miscarriage of justice.
Great. How does someone who doesn't know anything about this, but they only know what they've heard on the news and they only, you know, have limited access to information, how can we get to a point to understand the miscarriage of justice? I mean, can you summarize it? Can you, like, summarize it in bullet points in some way that that is not too complicated?
Well, basically, apart from the fact that I know that she is innocent because of the level of intimacy I have with the family, the fact remains that that no one takes marijuana to Bali from Australia. No one ever has, and it's very likely that no one ever will, simply because the value of marijuana in Australia is approximately 8 times what it is in Bali. Therefore, there's just simply no motive for taking marijuana to Bali. And indeed, Australia is not a drug exporting nation. We are a drug importing nation, but certainly not a drug exporting one.
Do you are you able to quantify the value of the marijuana which was seized, which they said that she'd brought into the country? What do you know what the street value in Australia of that marijuana would have been?
Well, there are a few differing opinions on that, but what I've heard ranges anything from about $32,000 to about $40,000 in
okay.
Australia.
Okay.
And the same value in Bali would be somewhere between $4,000 and $5,000.
Okay, so that's...
Could I possibly just comment there briefly, Roy?
Yes.
I actually did a little bit of investigation into this through a few baggage handlers that I know through my employment. And also, over the years, I've been into motorcycles and bands. I'm sort of aware of the drug scene as well. The point has been made, but there's no evidence of it. But just so you understand it, and I've been talking to a lot of people around the place and friends of mine, and there is a belief in the public in Australia, and I don't think this is your best evidence, but I personally think there's been a great miscarriage of justice against Chappelle. I definitely agree with that. But the facts are that the high quality of marijuana that we can get in this country is a draw to some of the surfing crowd and some of the regular people in Bali. And I actually know someone that lives in Bali he's got a residence there. He said that he has heard of them bringing higher grades of marijuana to cater to that wealthier, surfy sort of sect that want that strength of marijuana. Now, how do you respond to that?
Well, I guess what you're referring to is the marijuana that's known as Aussie Gold. The truth of the matter is that Aussie Gold is actually a myth. Tony Wilson, who wrote a book called Chappelle, The Facts, The Evidence, The Truth, he actually went onto the streets of Bali during his investigations for the writing of the book and actually yep. questioned a number of drug dealers in Kuta, and none of them had ever heard of Aussie Gold, and they'd also never heard of Chappelle or Mercedes prior to her arrest. And they were also saying that if there was such a thing as Aussie Gold, that obviously, and it was in demand, that there would be obviously quite a demand for it, and there would need to be a regular supply of the drug into the country, which would then imply that Aussie Gold was going over there on a fairly regular basis.
Well, that's an excellent and obvious answer, and it's something that I've thought myself, and I think you've articulated it perfectly, because we know that the Balinese can recreate anything. They create things cheaper and better than we can. So, of course, they would do that with their drugs if there was a need for hydroponic, high-quality ganja or whatever you want to call it, marijuana, over there in Bali. I'm sure they would find a way of providing it direct and cut the Australians out of the market. That makes complete sense to me. Good answer.
Well, I mean, hydroponic marijuana can be grown anywhere. It doesn't have to be in Australia. And I have actually heard that the Sumatran marijuana, which I believe is available in Indonesia, is actually leaves the hydroponic marijuana in the shade for strength and quality of smoke.
There you go. So, okay, we've got through that one. So I'm just going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate, because I've been asking people what they think, trying to get a feel for this. And these are some of the questions that seem to be very strong in people's minds.
Now, that's extremely important. But obviously, that's one piece of, I guess, exculpatory, evidence. But, of course, that in itself isn't enough to prove guilt or innocence. It's just, it's another piece of evidence which is important. But can we move to other more substantive issues here that indicate, at the very least, a miscarriage of justice? I mean, I've heard about, for example, the problem with there's no security camera footage, and there's a problem with the fact that the bags were never weighed. Maybe you could just move into those points for us.
Yes, certainly. Well, there is no CCTV footage available from all the airports that Chappelle passed through on her trip from Brisbane to Bali. There was supposedly CCTV footage available at Brisbane Airport, but once the Corby started trying to get hold of that, they received any number of different stories about the fate of the footage. Eventually, the footage was never supplied. And the final word that they were given was that the cameras were not actually switched on. Similarly, in Sydney Airport, there was no CCTV footage available there from the baggage handling area. I believe that all the cameras were actually found to be facing the wall that day, and that's also very significant because on that very day that Chappelle's bag passed through Sydney International, Sydney Domestic and Sydney International airports, there was an operation known as Operation Mocha in progress at the airport, which is basically an AFP operation attempting to catch baggage handlers using unsuspecting travellers' bags for the importation of cocaine. Mm-hmm. It seems rather strange that if that operation was occurring that day, that the cameras would not have been working in Sydney International Airport or Sydney Domestic.
So, Roy, this must have all, this Chappelle Corby incident, correct me if I'm wrong, it must have happened before September 11 because the security's been through the roof since then.
Well, that's exactly right. And
But it didn't, did it? It was 2002.
It was 2005, or 2004, wasn't it?
Sorry, there you go. Like,
sorry. Let's get the date right. I think was it? Could you just clarify the date for us, Roy?
The date that Chappelle travelled was the 8th of October 2004.
2004, great.
And on that day, a major cocaine shipment did come into Sydney Airport, and I understand that baggage handlers were arrested sometime after that. There were AFP officers in the airport on that day conducting, Operation Mocha, which I'm sure you've heard about. It seems unlikely that they would have accepted CCTV cameras being unavailable or switched off or broken down when they're conducting a major operation to try and catch baggage handlers bringing cocaine to the country.
Oh, mate, I just know, when I'm, supervising at work, I've got access to stacks of camera footage just from an engineering point of view. Like, it's absolutely astounding, and that's why I was making that light point about the fact that it must have been before September 11, because the surveillance in the airports, especially the international airport, is, but if there's misconduct in the workplace at any stage, they can pull up a footage of anyone anywhere at any time, basically. The only place they can't get access to is our locker rooms, etc. Pretty much everywhere else is covered.
Okay. Well, just moving on. So the footage wasn't available from Sydney Airport. And did she also request the footage from Bali Denpasar Airport?
Yes, she did. There was her lawyers did ascertain that there was a camera directly above the customs counter where her bag was presented and opened in front of the customs officer. Obviously, there was a bit of a conflict in the testimony given by Chappelle and the customs officer. She requested her and her defense lawyers requested that footage be made available in court to prove that she was telling the truth and the customs officer was lying. The judge initially said he would look into it. He later said, we'll get it if we need to. And in the end, he never found the need. It is significant that had the camera footage have proved that Chappelle was lying, it was hardly likely that she would ask for that to be presented in evidence. He would have thought it would have been more the prosecution asking for it to prove that their customs officer was telling the truth.
Indeed. So there was another piece of evidence which wasn't available to her to, I guess, because there was an argument, that was made that she was argumentative or that she was not agreeing with the search. If she'd been able to show the footage, that would have refuted that argument that she didn't. Because I think from what I remember reading, she said she cooperated with the search and they said that she tried to stop them from searching or something like that. Is that correct?
Well, that's what the customs officer claimed. Chappelle testified that she willingly opened the bag in front of the customs officer before he'd even asked her to do so. Her brother had actually taken the boogie board bag to the counter. One of the reasons for that is that Chappelle was struggling with her baggage. She had a fair bit, and one of her friends said to James, "Look, help your sister with her bags," and he dragged the boogie board bag to the counter. The reason he had to drag it, of course, was because the main carry handle on the bag had been cut. And when he got to the counter, the customs officer, Gusti Wanata, whose command of English was pretty poor, in fact so poor that he used a translator in court, asked James if the bag was his. But before he could answer, Chappelle said, no, it's mine, picked it up and put it on the counter, noticed that the zips had been tampered with, but didn't really think too much about it at the time, and then willingly opened the bag for inspection, expecting there just to be a boogie board bag and a pair of flippers in the bag.
Okay, and
Roy,
of course,
just a question on that thought, because I heard a rumor myself, and I had it confirmed today by a few people that there was a rumor that the bag was actually on the carousel going around by itself, and no one was coming to get it. And it was quite strange that Chappelle didn't pick up a bag that was the last one on the carousel. Is that true?
Look, I can't really say if that's true or not.
Okay, but okay. I heard that today, but I haven't seen any evidence of it.
No.
Okay, so that's hearsay.
Okay, so there you go, just more hearsay. There's plenty of hearsay, but not much evidence.
But what we do know is that when the bag was opened, there was a big, was it shrink wrapped? Was it like a hard brick? Was it the way they sort of packaged?
Well, basically, it was a vacuum sealed bag.
Right.
And it was compressed to a degree, yes.
Okay, so was it a kilo or?
Well, there was 4.2 kilos 4.2 of marijuana
kilos
in the bag, but it was partially compressed, but due to the vacuum seal, there was actually two bags, one within the other. The inner bag had actually been slashed right across the side for reasons unknown, but one can only assume that it may have been to help the smell of the marijuana escape. Because I see. Why would you do that yourself if you were trying to smuggle the stuff in?
So the inner bag had been slashed so that you could actually smell it.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, I didn't know that. And this bag full of 4.2 kilos of cannabis was just bouncing around inside the boogie board bag, partially cut open. And so the minute it was opened, that would have been quite a waft of smell then that came out of there.
It would have been, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That would have been quite shocking. So four kilos, I mean, that's quite a substantial weight. Now, from what I understand, Chappelle has tried to request weight measurements from Sydney and comparing it to Bali. Is that what happened?
Well, basically, I mean, all her baggage was weighed in Brisbane, but because they don't have individual bag weights, it was a collective weight of all her bags, including the boogie board bag. And she did have that weight available, and she did ask if the bags could all be weighed in Bali and a weight comparison done, but the police decided claimed that it was not necessary.
It's now changed now that they're individually weighed, and the system has changed to make sure this won't happen again, from what I've heard.
Okay, so the courts there just ruled that was sort of inadmissible and it wasn't relevant or whatever. They're just not interested in it.
The police weren't even interested in doing it. They said it wasn't necessary.
Okay, so that rules out that method of proving her innocence. What about fingerprints? What about fingerprints?
Well, yes, she did request fingerprinting of the outer bag and later on the inner bag as well. Initially, the outer bag was handled by customs officers and police at the airport, none of whom were wearing gloves, thereby contaminating the outer bag with their fingerprints, rendering that basically impossible to fingerprint because too many people had handled that bag. Any evidence that would have obtained would have been inconclusive. The inner bag, however, was not actually touched initially. It was only in court when the inner bag was finally pulled out of the outer bag, basically untouched by anybody, that the defense once again asked for fingerprinting. But in the meantime, the judge started handling the bag himself without gloves, and he called over the members of the prosecution and the customs officers, who all came over and handled the bag, despite the Corbys, you know, calling for it to be untouched and fingerprinted. And then he later said that the inner bag couldn't be fingerprinted either because too many people had touched it.
Look, can we just pause right there? I just think this is a really important point, and I wish we had a lawyer on this show, because I suspect that if that happened in a court here, that would be a case for a mistrial or a retrial or something, wouldn't it? I mean, under our system of law, if something like the inability of the police to get any kind of forensic evidence other than circumstantial evidence, and then to basically make it impossible to get that evidence, to tamper with it in a sense, I'd really just like to have a lawyer to confirm that. But it seems to me that under our system, that would be grounds for some kind of mistrial right there.
Well, I would think so. They certainly went out of their way to make sure that Chappelle would not be able to get any evidence to support her innocence in Bali. This is interesting because in denying her that evidence to prove her innocence, they were also denying themselves that same evidence to prove her guilt.
Right. Indonesian
law requires that you have some form of secondary evidence with which to back up primary evidence. Obviously, the primary evidence was the marijuana. And they needed some sort of secondary evidence in order to back up that primary evidence in order for the courts to be able to convict Chappelle. And all these sorts of things like fingerprinting, weighing of the bags, and, of course, the other important point which you haven't touched on yet is the forensic testing of the marijuana. Had Chappelle been guilty, all these things would have gone against her and would have more than provided them with the secondary evidence they required.
Okay, let's move on to the forensic testing of the marijuana then. So was this another thing that was requested from Chappelle's team?
Yes, it was requested from Chappelle's team, and Chappelle actually signed an authorization allowing the Australian Federal Police to forensically test the marijuana to determine its country of origin. And you have to remember that in a situation like this, the AFP have no real jurisdiction in Indonesia, and their only brief in situations like that is to assist the prosecution. So she was basically taking a risk by asking for that. Because had it proven that the drugs were from Brisbane, it would have given the prosecution a prima facie case, would have gone very much against her. And had during the process of that forensic testing, they found hair or skin fragments in the bag, and tested them and found that they matched Chappelle's DNA, she would have no choice but to change her plea to guilty, basically. But they decided not to do any of that. In fact, they refused. They not only refused to do it in Indonesia, but they actually refused to give the Australian Federal Police a sample of the marijuana for testing.
Okay, so it looks like they're ruling out all of the kind of standard forms of forensic examination. Now, what's left is circumstantial evidence, correct?
Well, basically, yes.
Okay. Okay, I want to get into this whole question of circumstantial evidence and exactly what they've provided. We're just going to have a very short break and we'll be right back and get into that.
Okay.
Propaganda. Disinformation. Misinformation. Deception. Deceit. Spin. Untruths. Half-truths. Lies. You know the truth. Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia. www.truthnews.com.au.
Okay, well, we're back with Truth News and we're back with the Chappelle Corby story, miscarriage of justice as it has been proclaimed by many people, including some quite renowned songwriters, and we're going to have play a sample of one of those songs. And I have with me tonight Roy Reeves, who's a close friend of the Corby family, and we're going through some of the evidence that could basically either prove guilt or innocence. And what we've come up with is that it looks as like a systematic approach was taken from the police and the courts to strip Chappelle of any kind of forensic evidence that might have been able to prove her guilt or innocence. And what we're left with is circumstantial evidence that, well, the drugs were in her bag and she said it was her bag, therefore she's guilty. It's pretty open and shut. As soon as you strip away all the other forms of checking, you're just left with that. And of course, I guess the case must have been pretty quick then, Roy. I mean, what was left? I guess there was character. She could have said that she's a person of good character. Did that come up in the courts as a part of her defence?
I don't believe it did come up as part of her defence. However, she did test negative to all drugs, thereby proving that she's not a drug user.
Okay.
She has no criminal history, no criminal record of any kind in Australia, and we have police certificates to prove that, AFP police certificates to prove that. She's never used illicit drugs, and as I say, the test proved that. So from that point of view, I mean, she was a law-abiding citizen in Australia, clean-living young girl. She was, studying to be a beautician. She was looking after her dying father, basically doing the right thing by him. She was basically a lovely person.
Okay, and the initial trial, how long did it take before we actually went to trial after she was initially arrested?
I think the trial started in January, from what I can recall. She was arrested in October.
October, January, and. How long did that go on before she was finally convicted?
Well, basically, the verdict was handed down on the 27th of May 2005.
2005, right. Now, it was in the news a lot at that time and, through 2005. And I remember during that time I was following it quite a lot because I was pretty interested in the story. And there was a lot of talk from Australia. Even John Howard spoke up about it. It seemed like the government here was trying to help her, and there was a guy who was in prison, and I think at some point he was actually flown over to Bali to testify on her behalf, or did that happen later? Was that during the appeal?
No, that was during the trial. John Ford was flown over to Bali to testify. Of course, as you know, the Corbys were running with a defence based on the fact that there was a possibility that baggage handlers had inserted the drugs between Brisbane and Sydney, basically in Brisbane for transportation to Sydney. As we've already discussed, Chappelle was basically stripped of any evidence in Bali which he could use for a defence.
Right.
So her lawyers were sort of basically then forced to look to Australia for some way to prove her innocence. And because it is known that passengers' baggage is used on occasions to transport drugs interstate and also to import drugs from overseas, they looked at this as a possible means of defence.
Now, if we're going to run with that argument, I just need to understand the argument, because so if we're saying that this was actually a drug courier gone wrong, that it mistakenly went on to Bali, or was it deliberately sent on to Bali? Can you elaborate on that? And if the bag was deliberately opened, why was that done? Because that almost sounds like it was more intentional, that that someone was trying to incriminate someone. Why would that have occurred, and why would it have gone on to Bali, or was it just a mistake?
Well, the truth of the matter is that I don't personally think that the drugs were inserted in Brisbane for transportation to Sydney. And I'm not the only one who believes that. Large numbers of the Chappelle Corby supportment believe that. At the time, it was a legitimate defence because it was known that passengers' bags had been used to transport drugs interstate. I don't believe it was on a large scale. The Wheeler report into airport security, which was conducted 4 months after Chappelle's verdict, did ascertain that cannabis is moved through Australian airports in passengers' baggage. There would certainly have been no reason for these drugs to have been inserted in Brisbane to go on to Bali. To be sold for a fraction of their street value in Australia. So I personally believe that the drugs were actually inserted in Indonesia.
Okay, so you're claiming, your hypothesis is that the drugs were inserted in Indonesia and possibly originated from Indonesia. Right, I guess we'll never know.
Yes.
Why would they have done that? Any idea, any suggestion as to why that would have been done?
Well, it has been suggested that that they may have been seeking UN War on Drugs funding. The chief of Bali police, Aimare Pastika, had announced just a few months prior to Chappelle's arrest that he announced a tough on drugs campaign. But because the economy of Bali was in tatters after the Bali bombings and there wasn't a lot of money around, he basically didn't really have the money to fund a really tough on drugs campaign, and he was hoping to get UN War on Drugs funding. And the only way to achieve this, there was basically after his announcement that there was no funding forthcoming, and we theorise that the Indonesian police may have put these drugs in Chappelle's bags to give the impression that a new and disturbing development in transnational drug trafficking was taking place.
Okay, right. Of course,
had never gone to Bali before from Australia. For a bag of that quantity of drugs to suddenly turn up would give the impression that there was a new and disturbing development taking place.
Right. Of course, that remains speculation, and really, it's sort of we can't really do much with that. I mean, there's a lot of questions around, I guess, the procedures of airport security, which I guess if you're claiming that it was inserted in Bali, then, I mean, I was going to ask John about the airport security issues. John, what's your take on all this? And we may have lost John. He might have dropped out. Okay. Are you there, John? Okay, look, I'm just going to try and reconnect with John. So okay. Just hang on there, Roy.
Yes.
Okay, we've got John back on the line. And John, are you there?
I am.
Yeah, and Roy, are you with us?
Yes, I'm still there.
Excellent. Okay, John, I was just about to throw a question out to you in regards to airport security, because Roy is actually theorising that the drugs may have been put in the bag in Bali. Actually, I'm getting a bit of background noise there. Is anyone else hearing that?
Yeah, a little bit, I've got a bit.
It might, hopefully it might settle itself down, yeah. Roy's, hypothesized that the drugs might have been put at the airport in Bali. I mean, how likely is it, in your opinion, that the drugs had, been sent down from Brisbane on some sort of drug courier thing and then mistakenly were sent on to Bali? I mean, does that sound plausible to you?
That's the one I lean towards. If it's not a case, not to lay any blame on anyone in Chappelle's family, there is, we can maybe talk about this a little bit later. I think it's, some people have come to the conclusion it might have been someone else in her family or someone she knew that placed them. That being ruled out by other evidence that maybe Roy can go on to, I think the next most likely thing is the idea that it was being transported from Brisbane, because she flew a domestic sector from Brisbane to Sydney. Now it's I know that it has happened. There's evidence that this has gone on, and I don't think it's going on now. There's been a lot of changes at work over since Chappelle. She's really tightened the whole thing up because of what's happened to her. So maybe that's the thing that's come out of it. But
Roy proposed earlier, just update you, because Roy proposed earlier that the drugs, that it was the Indonesians who put them in there. Although I think that both of those could be correct. You see, because if
we don't know,
it could be a combination. Because if, as Roy is suggesting, that the Indonesian government was interested in highlighting a drug problem in order to get UN support or whatever, mm-hmm. if that was going on, that could easily have been coordinated with covertly at the Sydney end as well. There's no reason why.
I'm sure all those things could, we know anything can happen, through some of the things we've investigated. But, I don't know. The only one that I think, that Roy provides some background that makes sense on that, in his lecture, he provides some background. And I think, the article in the Hard Evidence magazine lays out a case for that as well, the possibility of it. The one that really got me, from what I know, and it's just an idea, is the idea that they were transferring it. Because to transfer quantities of hydroponic marijuana between states, that definitely happens regularly, especially out of Adelaide, where it's, a lot of it comes across the border in trucks. My father worked in drug and alcohol for a lot of years with the police, so I was sort of aware of that. But, talking to some fellows at work, and knowing the history of what's going on with the airlines domestically, definitely the idea of someone using someone else's bag to transfer drugs on aircraft domestically makes sense, and it's been done. So, I think there's definitely credence to that argument. The idea of, Roy said at the beginning, the idea of transferring hydroponic marijuana overseas through the dogs and the security, is insane. It's just, there might have been a market for it. That's what I was trying to establish. I was trying to be the devil's advocate by putting forward that idea. But to send it domestically, it's not unreasonable, because even though now the bags are x-rayed, all the domestic bags are x-rayed, they weren't back in 2004. And, the idea of slipping in some marijuana, a deal between one baggage handler that knows he's going to attend a certain flight, and the same in Sydney, a mobile phone call, it'll be in this bag, mate. It's a very smart way of transporting drugs, because it takes out a lot of the danger for the drug couriers. And I think that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense to me, Roy.
Right. Well, so we've got two competing alternative views there. It doesn't seem like we're going to make much progress on getting any facts to substantiate those. I'm just wondering.
Well, that idea has been that there have been cases, but where they've used other people's bags to transfer drugs. Isn't that true, Roy?
Well, yes, there have been cases where drugs have been carried in other people's bags, and in fact, the shipment of cocaine that came into Sydney on the 8th of October did come in an unsuspecting traveller's bag.
But, John, your theory hasn't explained why the bag ended up going on to Bali.
Because someone was, this happens all the time. They drop the booty because there's a risk of getting caught. We know that Operation Mocha was happening that day.
But then I have to ask the question, why was the bag slashed?
Well, we don't know. It was the internal bag Roy was saying, and I'm not really. We don't really have photographic evidence or video evidence that proves any of this. Like, this is all really just on what we've been told.
No, but I'm just asking the question about the bag being slashed, because that's agreed.
Who knows? They could have, someone could have picked it up earlier on, because, like I said, once it goes international, once these hydroponic drugs, which Roy says there's no precedent for, and I believe he's probably right, they're going to get picked up. But, it's possible that it was meant to get off in Sydney, didn't happen because they were worried because of the operation. There was a rumour, someone got scared, whatever, pulled out, the bag ends up in Bali, and it gets smelt by the dogs, and they go, oh, here it is. So they think, what's in there? Oh, look at this. We're going to wait for the person and we're going to bust them. Maybe that's what happened. Who knows?
Oh, so you're saying it's possible that before the bag came off the carousel, it was already opened by the
customs? They'd already figured out
customs.
What was there, because the dogs had picked it up. They've got dogs in Bali, haven't they, Roy?
I'm not sure if they have or not. I know that they do. They do run the bags over a under X-rays.
They can pick it up in the X-ray too. They clearly see that in the X-ray. There's no doubt about
it. Steve Bonata testified that he was examining the drugs coming through. Okay, this was the customs officer. However, normally the Bali customs will put a yellow cross on bags which they consider to be suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
So this bag on this occasion did not have a yellow cross on it.
Okay.
The other thing, of course, about the bag is the fact that the main carrying handle had been cut. Now, the fact that the handle was cut would have meant that the owner of the bag would probably have to have used a trolley or dragged it across the floor, to get it to the customs counter, thereby not noticing the extra weight in the bag.
How do we know it was cut, Roy?
Oh, because it was.
It's clearly cut with a knife. It's not torn.
No, it had been cut. And
Does Chappelle claim that it was cut by, did she cut it or did someone else cut it?
It was perfectly okay when she checked the bag in, and when she picked up, the main carrying handle had been cut. There was no yellow cross on the bag now, which thereby means that the customs officer who's supposedly scanning the incoming bags either lied when he said that there was nothing suspicious about the bag, or they deliberately didn't put a yellow cross on it as a way of entrapping the owner, because if the owner had checked the bag in Brisbane with no drugs in there and then they suddenly get to Bali and there's a yellow cross on it denoting a suspicious bag, they might think, well, hang on, I better leave that bag alone because the customs have found something in it, even though there shouldn't have been something in it.
So this is the whole thing. I think in a way we're sort of doing an injustice in a way with the whole argument. I know that's sort of what you have to do because people are asking all these dumb questions. The fact that the handle of the bag was cut completely wipes it out as evidence to me because it's been tampered with. The fact that we haven't got any weight, we haven't got any testing of the drugs, we haven't got any chain of custody. The case for Corby, from what I can see, there's nothing really that proves the case. They've got a prima facie case because the drugs are in her bag. But there's nothing else, is there? There's this smear and BS.
You're not actually quite correct there. Having the drugs in her bag did not represent a prima facie case. They needed some additional evidence to make it a prima facie case.
Okay.
Forensically testing the drugs to prove that they came from Brisbane would have given them a prima facie case. And
because the bag's out of her control during that trip, that consequently negates the prima facie case unless they can prove the drugs are there before transportation.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, if you are correct, and I'm not saying you're not correct, that the drugs were inserted in Brisbane for transportation to Sydney, when they finally got to Bali, it would have represented a genuine case of importation, transnational drug importation into Bali, and they would have then given the police the freedom to conduct a full and proper investigation into the whole thing, which would have included weighing the bag. Testing for fingerprints, testing the drugs to prove that they came from Brisbane, and that would have given the prosecution a prima facie case and more than sufficient secondary evidence to put Chappelle away, but they did none of those things.
So how could they convict her then? How were they able to convict her? Because you're saying they didn't have a prima facie case.
Well, basically, they had the primary evidence, which was the marijuana in her bag, and by way of secondary evidence, they eventually used testimony. It was all they had, the testimony of the customs officer at the main desk, the testimony of a second customs officer who was in the customs room that the bag was eventually taken to, and two police officers in the airport who claim that they heard Chappelle say she owned the marijuana, and also claimed that they saw her trying to push Winata's hand away when he tried to open the bag. It was all basically testimony. The two police officers who said that they confirmed that you know, Gusty's testimony that Chappelle had admitted owning the marijuana couldn't speak English. Gusty Winata himself, his command of English was so poor that he actually used an interpreter in court. And he testified in court that Chappelle had admitted the bag was hers, and admitted that the marijuana was hers. And yet, funnily enough, when he first asked James if the bag was his, and Chappelle said, "No, it's mine," he then leads James away. Ultimately, James got led away with the bag, and Chappelle was left in the airport free to leave if she wished. Now, if his command of the English language was so good that he was quite certain that Chappelle had admitting owning the bag and the marijuana, why did he then lead James away into another room and leave Chappelle basically free to go if she wished?
It's alarming, isn't it? I tell you what, do what I've done. Get on Chappelle.net and sign these petitions that are there, because this is just ridiculous. It's politicised. It's got nothing to do with her guilt at all, has it, Roy?
Yeah. No, it hasn't. And the other thing I really need to point out is that although you say that my theory that the drugs were inserted in Bali is a theory, and I admit that it is, it seems that the Balinese police were very, very determined to make sure that the origin of the drugs was never, ever established. They refused to forensically test it. They refused to allow the Australian Federal Police a sample for testing. And then they ultimately burnt the evidence, the drugs and the bag and the boogie board, all untested, the country of origin, even before her appeals process was complete.
Right.
Now,
well, that
they do something like that when testing the evidence and proving that it was for Brisbane would have done their case so much good.
Okay. That is, I mean, from our point of view, I guess from our legal system, that just sounds like miscarriage of justice right there.
She wouldn't have been charged in Australia, would she, Roy?
Well, she may have been charged with possession, but she wouldn't have been charged with, I mean, they say she imported the drugs, and yet they never proved the drugs were Australian. So how can they say she imported them if they didn't actually prove that they were Australian? They also charged her with trafficking, and yet they did no investigation in Bali whatsoever to establish how Chappelle intended to dispose of these drugs once she'd got them through. They never questioned a single person. They never presented a single piece of evidence in court to support the trafficking charge, and yet she was still found guilty of trafficking, which essentially added another 10 years to her sentence.
Look, I just want to emphasise for our listeners that, you know, in any kind of case like this, all the facts are always complicated and there's always a lot of grey areas. But I see something pretty clear, something pretty crystal clear, and you've sometimes got to just clear away all of that foggy stuff, because it's irrelevant. What is relevant and important is whether or not there was enough information to convict her under a basic legal system. We have to use our legal system as a reference here. And I mean, I'd say under our legal system, clearly there wasn't. Maybe under the Indonesian legal system there was, but and all these things basically come down to the law basically operates on these very, strict principles, and there just wasn't enough evidence there to, under our terms, prove anything other than that it was in the bag when she opened the bag. Okay, so let's just really get that clear, because I do want to get into some of the other issues that have cropped up to do with allegations that her family was involved in drugs, etc. But before we do that, and I want to give Roy a chance to sort of clear all that up as well. But before I do that, I want to play a song, which is by the title of the song is "When You Tried to Tell the World," and can you give me the name of the person, Roy? I can't see it on here on YouTube.
Holly
I've got
Wilson.
YouTube up. Holly Wilson. Yeah, okay. I'm just about to play the song by Holly Wilson. So we'll just kick that off and we'll get right back after that.
Try to tell the world what went on. door swings open, another slams closed. Behind the others, Lord only knows. But in the break dawn hour, there are things that I see clear. Invisible visions that ears can't hear. And still in awe, it makes sense.
Getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Okay, welcome back to the show, and welcome back our guests, John and Roy. Are you guys there?
Yes, I am.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm here.
Excellent. Yeah, look, it was a really beautiful song, and I just wanted to point out that Roy sent me a list of songs, and there's a lot of people thinking about Chappelle. A lot of people, creative artists, aware of this issue. A lot of people around the world. There's groups who've investigated this, and I was actually contacted, believe it or not, I was contacted earlier this year, totally independently, by some people in the UK who found truthnews.com.au and wanted me to do this. And I'm sure they'll be pleased to hear that we've actually done a show on it. Look, can we get into the question of the kind of the media smear campaign that was that popped up around Chappelle Corby's family and Mercedes Corby, because I think that has had a big effect on what people think. But I do know that, and I don't know the details of it, I haven't really studied up on it, but I do know that there was a defamation case and that Mercedes Corby won the defamation case. But can you just elaborate it and explain the whole thing for us, Roy?
Well, yes, basically... it was all to do with Today Tonight segment, I think back in February 2007, where Mercedes' ex-friend Jodie Powers got on the Today Tonight show and made a lot of allegations about the about Mercedes and about the Corby family in general, which were defamatory.
Okay, what kind of claims were made? And I mean, we just briefly just want to explain what claims were made. I mean, this was to do with drug dealing or something like that, was it?
Well, she basically claimed that that the Corbys had been involved with drugs for a long time. That they had space bags of marijuana sitting around in the lounge room. She'd been asked if she would take marijuana to Bali.
These are extraordinary allegations. I mean, yeah. these are totally, in terms of the court of public opinion. I mean, that's just devastating, and you can't underestimate how what an effect that has. It's just absolutely devastating.
She said that Chappelle's mother was flying around Australia with bags of marijuana. She said that they had a customs officer in their employ at Nururai Airport in Bali. Basically, she was making them out to be one of the biggest drug families in Australia.
Now, and subsequently, Mercedes Corby... Sorry.
She did also say that she feared for her life having done the interviews, thereby implying that the Corbys would get a hitman to have a go at her.
Now,
can I just jump in there just while we're on this point? But they're not a perfect family, are they, right? Like in some ways, the family's been used against us because they're a working class family that's had a few run-ins here and there with the law. Like some of her, half brothers, She doesn't have the perfect background, and this is one of the things that makes me even more sad for Chappelle, is that she hasn't had the perfect life. And
I just want to clarify, John. I've got from Roy a set of scans of police record, and Roy has previously claimed that there is no one in her direct family who has any criminal. Although, correct me if I'm wrong, Roy, but
your father has a history.
That's not true, John. Her father was caught at a party back in the 70s where a small amount of marijuana was found, I think about 2 grams.
2 grams, yeah.
And he happened to have a broken leg at the time, and when everyone else scattered, he was unable to get away, and was basically charged with possession or being at a place where marijuana was present, for which he received a $400 fine, but no conviction was ever recorded against his name.
Well, there you go. Well, that clears that up. But I just knew there was something.
Well, that's extraordinary. That's nothing.
That's nothing.
Okay.
There's nothing. The actual Corby family themselves. Of course, there is Chappelle's half brothers, Clinton Rose, does have a bit of a checkered past, but none of his crimes include drugs or drug trafficking or the drug trade as such. The only person that's ever really been charged with a drug crime was young James, who did a break and enter one night. He felt that in this particular house there were known to be drug dealers, and he felt that maybe if he grabbed a sample of the drugs, he may be able to help his sister in Bali. It was a stupid act that he did while he'd had too many drinks, and that was his only brush with the law.
So this is Chappelle's younger brother.
Yeah, the brother who travelled with her to Bali, James. Yes.
So he did a break and enter after Chappelle was arrested.
Well after, yes.
And he was convicted of that.
Yes, he was.
So is this her half brother or her full brother? So I'm just getting confused with
her. A half brother.
Oh, okay, so that's her. Is he the son of the father who we've been talking about, or is he the son of?
He's a son of one of Rosalie's other partners. She's had children by three men.
I see.
But that's her business, basically. The actual Corbys themselves, Mercedes, Michael, and Chappelle were all fathered by Michael Corby Sr. And then Clinton was one on his own. And then there was young James and Melianne, who were fathered by someone else.
Right, okay. Look, I just want to get back to this these claims of Jodie Powers, because I just find this absolutely incredible. Because when I see this level of defamation going on, I become very suspect about it, because I mean, there's usually a motive.
AFP.
So, well, yeah,
AFP are involved, mate. That's what makes me wonder.
Well, okay, yeah. How does you think the AFP is connected, John?
Well, they just always seem to be doing these political deals with the people in Indonesia. Just got to talk to people about the Bali bombing and other things that have happened up there. They don't work. You know, they don't work nice, and they work behind closed doors. These people, and you see these sorts of fix set in. Like when I heard what Roy was saying, looked into it a bit more deeply. It just seems like there's some sort of fix in. You know, like it just does that seem like to you, Roy? There's a fix in there.
Well, I think the most significant thing about the whole Jody Powers claim on national TV is the fact that had even a fraction of what she said been true, you would have expected that the police would have been round to the Corby's household almost straight away.
Absolutely.
To run sweeps, you can obviously run cloths or whatever it is over surfaces and detect THC. They would have been looking at the garden to see if there was any evidence of marijuana plants having been planted in the garden. And I believe you can test soil samples up to 3 years down the track and determine whether marijuana plants have been grown in the ground. As I say, you would have expected at least a few policemen to come around to the house to check out to see if these claims were true. But in the end, not a single policeman ever turned up there.
And
so obviously the police didn't believe Jody Powers' claims, or they were being very derelict in their duty.
And she immediately launched a civil lawsuit against Channel 7, correct?
Well, she not immediately, but fairly soon afterwards. Yes, she did.
And
her mother.
Okay. And did it actually go to court, or did they settle before it went to court?
Well, no. Mercedes' defamation case did go to court, and she won convincingly. And Rosli was going to sue them after Mercedes had finished, but having lost the case to Mercedes, they decided there was not much point in contesting the case against Rosli, and they just settled out of court with her.
So because it went to court, it's public information what was said in court and what the information came out. Can you summarise what the outcome of that court case was? I mean, obviously, this girl was lying, right?
Yes, obviously she was lying. I mean, Channel 7, I understand, hired a private investigator to investigate the Gorbys while they were preparing their case for the defence, because they were basically the defendants.
Yes.
And I think they paid him somewhere in the region of $800,000 or $900,000 to dig up anything and everything he possibly find on the Corby family. And the best he was able to come up with was a few photographs of Mercedes smoking bongs in her teens, and a few letters that he sent to Jody when she was also young and stupid, talking about drugs.
Yes, we've all seen the photograph of Mercedes Corby sucking on a pipe. Everyone in Australia has seen that.
Yes. This is what I was pointing at.
We've all been exposed to that.
Working class family, these sorts of things are normal in average working class families in Australia, aren't they, you know?
Oh, not just working class, everyone.
Exactly.
I'm just trying to give an example of, to take a photo, you know. But, well, anyway, it's just, you know, it's just seen as, it's not really unusual behaviour, is it?
I think most of the people in that generation, and probably even in current generation, all experiment with marijuana. And so there's nothing unusual about it. Even Chappelle admitted in her book, My Story, that she'd tried marijuana and just didn't find it to her liking and never used it after that.
But not a skerrick of drug in her blood or urine or anything when they investigated her after this situation in Bali, which is like someone that's going to drink, you know, hydroponic marijuana over to Bali and they haven't got anything in their system. It's just ridiculous, isn't it?
It is very ridiculous. And why would a person who doesn't even like marijuana and doesn't like being around people who are stoned decide to take 4 kilos over there to try and sell on the streets in competition with the local drug dealers on a two-week holiday?
Insanity. Insanity. It just doesn't make any sense.
Now, it's been how long since she was incarcerated now? It's over 4 years, is it?
Well, it would be 5 years on October the 8th.
5 years. And how long is she sentenced? What is her current sentence?
Her current sentence was 20 years. She was initially sentenced to 20 years. It was reduced to 15 years on appeal. And then it was reinstated back to 20 years. She's had 10 months' worth of remissions for public holidays. Independence Day holidays and things like that. So basically on October the 8th, she'll still have 14 years and 2 months to run, barring further reductions in her sentence.
Right. And Can you just describe what sort of her conditions are like and what her current, you know, mental and emotional state is? I think that's pretty important for our listeners.
Well, obviously the conditions in Karobakan prison are awful, especially if you're a woman in a Muslim-dominated country. You're basically locked in your cell from 4:30 in the afternoon until 7:30 in the morning. And even when you're allowed out, you're in a small compound within the jail. The women's compound is actually a walled-off section. They don't have access to sporting equipment, television, electricity. There's only a very small amount of things that they're actually allowed to do. I mean, Chappelle was making beaded bracelets and doing a bit of reading, but she's now got to the state where she really can't read anymore.
Is she allowed access to the internet?
No, absolutely not. Boredom, I think, is one of the major problems with the sentence of that measure is what do you do for 20 years when you're really not allowed to basically do anything? I mean, she did ask some time ago if she could start beauty therapy classes for fellow prisoners, and that was denied. She asked if she could start a garden outside her cell. That was also denied. Crushing boredom has been one of her major problems. And, of course,
is she allowed to write? Is she allowed writing materials?
Oh, yeah, she is allowed to write, although she seldom writes these days.
Right.
As I say, the death of her father last year to cancer. Now, Mick Corby basically should have died about 2 years before he actually did, but he hung on as hard as he could to see his daughter come home free. But unfortunately, he died before that occurred. Then, just a matter of a few months later, she lost her stepfather, Greg. They both died of bowel cancer, and shortly after that, she found out that her judicial review to get her sentence quashed was rejected. So she then from that point onwards lost hope of ever being released, and then proceeded to go rapidly downhill.
Okay.
And she's now at a stage where she is essentially insane, with suicidal tendencies. She has attempted to actually take her life on a couple of occasions now by cutting her arms. I personally think that she wasn't entirely serious about it at this stage. It was probably a cry for help, but she has also climbed the towers within the jail, which are 9-meter water towers. She'd only have to fall off one of them and she would be dead almost without a doubt. And she may get to the stage down the track where she becomes so depressed and despondent that she does decide to take her life.
Does she get many visitors, Roy?
Well, she has her sister coming into the prison every day. The sister brings in her basic essentials, food, toiletries, of course, these more recently these days, Mercedes has actually had to go into the cell and help Chappelle wash and dress and eat. Chappelle has got the stage now where she gets so confused sometimes that she can't even dress herself. She really is in a very, very bad way. Sometimes she gets to a stage where she can't speak. She goes into a catatonic state and just sits there totally out of it for quite some time.
If you're listening out there and you're moved by this, please, as I have been, get on there and sign the petitions, write to the embassies, do what Roy asks at the website there, chappelle.net, because this girl needs some help, and if she dies, it's going to be partially our fault, so... Please get up and do something.
And I just want to point out that, you know, with Truth News, we've been exposing a lot of issues where there has been complete lies that are disseminated through the media. And one of the reasons why this is such an important story for us to bring up tonight, apart from, you know, the fact that I, you know, care about a person who's suffering, but is that this is another example of how we see the media acting as a totally Orwellian force in our society, basically shaping what people think. And I don't think people realize it. And I really want people to understand how damaged they have been by the way the media has destroyed the reputation of the Corby family. And there's no getting around it. The fact that her sister won the case makes no difference at all. Because all that matters is that the mud was flung, you know. The mud was flung and enough stuck. And that's all people remember. If someone came on television saying they had bags of dope everywhere and they were like some crime family, it's over. I mean, these people who run the media have access to millions of people around the country, homes. They beam their television into people's homes and they sit down at dinner time and they watch this stuff, and it programs and brainwashes them. It doesn't matter whether it was proven in court that it was a lie. It makes no difference at all. We've got a criminal system running our media, and that's got to be the main point that I want to make from this show. And I hope that at some point, Roy, if you're able to speak to Chappelle about this, to get her to understand that she's involved in a much bigger struggle that we're all involved in, that involves many other issues that have involved mass murder and crimes against humanity on a massive scale. And that, you know, we are in solidarity with her, and we are also all suffering from what is going on with this conspiracy of control for the purpose of propaganda and commercial exploitation, brainwashing and enslavement that is going on. So if that could in any way help her to understand that, I'd love it if you could communicate that to her, because it might just give her a sense that there's something to pick up her spirits, to understand that we're all in this together.
I just hope that
it might be one thing, because like sometimes people who are in an extremely difficult situation need to understand the bigger struggle and know that it's not just about one person, it's not about one situation. As soon as I saw that there'd been this media propaganda campaign against Chappelle, I knew exactly what was going on. I understood it in the context of all the other stuff that I've investigated over the last few years, with 9/11 and the Port Arthur massacres and various other things. And I see the same pattern over and over again. And that's what we're fighting. And it's a really important struggle. And it's really important that she stays alive.
I think one thing I would like to point out with the media smear campaign, that everything you say is true. The media smear campaign in relation to Chappelle was and is a deliberate campaign to turn the people of Australia away from the Corby family, to deaden their compassion for Chappelle and her situation. At the time of her trial, support in Australia for Chappelle and her family was running at 90%. And yet now, if you look at polls now, you'd be lucky to get 50-50, and that's just for, you know, when the question is, should she come home for medical treatment or should she come home to serve her sentence in Australia, you're still only going to get roughly 50-50. And I think if you were to run a poll on whether people think she's guilty or innocent now, you'll probably find the majority of people think she's guilty. And this has occurred purely and simply as a result of the smear campaign against the family, to turn people away from the family because
some egotistical little girl with a personality disorder was manipulated and bribed in some way to get on television and just put on a fake show. That's what happened.
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of things besides the Jodie Powers interview which have given people the wrong impression about Chappelle. The Current Affair ran a show back in March last year claiming that Chappelle and Mercedes regularly dine out together, and there was photos presented as evidence that this was Chappelle and Mercedes having a meal in a restaurant in Kuta. And the fact of the matter is it was a complete fabrication. Chappelle does not get out to go and have meals with her sister. The only time she's ever been out, apart from to attend court and to go to hospital, is to go to the dentist. I think she went to the dentist one time, but she never ever gets out to eat a meal.
No, yet, I heard that rumor today, Roy. Someone told me that today, that she gets out and she's like having a good time, and you know, it disgusts me. It really disgusts me.
It's totally ignorant. It's totally ignorant. I mean, the way the prison systems work there. I mean, she's in prison, okay. Now yeah. I know that those Indonesia does have bribery and corruption, okay. Now, I don't know exactly.
You all do. Some it's more obvious.
Yeah, yeah. And I certainly wouldn't hold it against her if she were able to, with a bit of bribery, occasionally get out. But, I mean, the prisons in that country are, you know, real. They're real. They exist. And that, yeah, of course what you're saying isn't going to happen. And of course they're not going to want her to escape anyway, because if she could get out, there's a chance she could escape and then the truth could really come out. So
the thing you have to understand that also is that Chappelle, whether she likes it or not, is a celebrity prisoner. When she moves anywhere outside that prison, the media are with her every step of the way, and not just a few, and not just one or two cameras, but you know, dozens of cameras flashing away in her face. I mean, when she was brought back into the prison after her most recent stopover in hospital, she was photographed coming out of the hospital. She wasn't even advised that she was leaving the hospital, but the media was certainly told that she was leaving the hospital.
And, so which media was this, Roy? Was this local media?
This must have been the Balinese media.
But
you know, these photos that were supposedly taken of Chappelle having a meal out, there was no evidence of guards in the photos who would have been watching her to make sure she didn't do a runner. And there wasn't this large contingency of media who would more than likely have been photographing her had she genuinely gone out to have a meal. The story was a complete and utter fabrication, and yet even today you still hear people saying that. She gets out to have a meal whenever she feels like it.
Well, I heard it today, and I just thought, well, how is that possible, you know? But anyway, it's a terrible situation, and people, they can really help, can't they, Roy, by just an email or a letter, you know, just some words of support. I see there's lots of websites now supporting Chappelle, so there's a bit of an internet revolution going on for her. Is that true?
Yes, there is. People from all around the world have been photographed holding up free Chappelle signs, and the whole and all the clips, all the pictures were put together, and they provide the video clip for the Tara Hack song "Sire to Dak Pizzala" that I sent you on that list.
Great, and look, we'll definitely put a lot of that stuff up on the show notes on the website, you know, I encourage everyone to look. Is there anything that our listeners can do? What can you encourage a listener to do to help to make a difference here?
Well, there is, of course, as John has already mentioned, the petition running for Chappelle. Now, this petition has been running for nearly 2 years. It's a Care 2 petition, and the target, the signature target was 50,000 signatures, but in nearly 2 years, we've only managed to acquire about 8,000 signatures, of which less than half are Australian. Most of them are from overseas, and they do come from all over the world. If you actually go to the petition site and look back through the signatures, you find people from every corner of the world signing the petition to bring Chappelle home. And yet the number of Australian signatures is alarmingly absent, although there are, of course, some. So certainly I would encourage everyone to go to that petition site and sign away as hard as they can, and encourage all their friends to do likewise. There is also another site that the support movement has running currently, which is a letter writing campaign. I'm sure I've sent you the links to both, which has pre-prepared letters for people to basically complete and send to the Prime Minister. And of course, for overseas listeners, there is a letter for international, for people who are in other countries that they can fill out and send to our Prime Minister, basically encouraging him and his government to make representation to the Indonesian government to bring Chappelle home on humanitarian grounds.
Mm. Now, yeah, why did that not happen? Because that was what I heard was going to happen at one stage. Why did that not happen? Was it the Indonesians said no?
Well, no one has actually said yes or no yet. We are the support movement is attempting to get Chappelle home on humanitarian grounds, and
but isn't it quite common for prisoners who are in Indonesia to be transferred back to Australia? Why is that even an issue?
It's not common because there is no prisoner transfer agreement with Australia. In fact, Indonesia has a prisoner transfer agreement with any other country.
Right. Okay. It happens with other countries, but not with Indonesia.
I don't think Indonesia has a prisoner transfer agreement with any other country.
Right. But we have prisoner transfer agreements with other countries, don't we?
We do, but not with Indonesia.
Yes.
And the Howard government was close to finalising a prisoner transfer agreement, but then they were voted out of office.
I see.
And it is significant also that the Prime Minister of Australia, the current Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, when he was in opposition, made quite a bit of noise about supporting Chappelle Corby and getting her home on a prisoner transfer agreement and providing all possible help for her, including, you know, applying for a presidential pardon. But since he's become a prime minister, he's pretty much shown no interest in her whatsoever, despite repeated letters to him and his government by members of the Corby family and also supporters.
Right. Right.
Just another weak populist. And Roy, you've done us the great honour of presenting during the Hard Evidence conference we're having in Sydney, www.thehardevidence.com, during the lunch break. You're going to give a short presentation to alert the 300-strong crowd of the situation there.
Yes, that's correct.
Excellent.
Thanks very much for that, mate. We're really looking forward to it for the people that want to stay back. But, you know, half hour, we've got about an hour and 15 for lunch, so people should still have enough time to get something to eat and get back and check that out. We could only just squeeze you in because we had a full bill.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm looking forward to coming down there.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Great. Well, look, that about wraps it up for tonight, folks. A really great honour having you with us tonight, Roy. And we'll keep... talking about this, I'd like to actually get some information, maybe even do a little promotional thing that we run every now and then on the show about it, just to remind people. I might talk to you about that at some point. Look, thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and John, thanks for your expert and excellent contributions tonight as well.
We're thinking about Chappelle today, that's for sure.
We certainly are.
Well, I think about her every day.
Good on you, mate.
Great.
Okay. I have done for the last, 5 years, basically, but as I say, in the last 2 years, he's been on my mind 24/7.
Great.
Keep it up, mate. You're doing a good job.
Thanks a lot. And
thank you.
On that note, it's good night from me and good night from Truth News Australia.
Okay, good night.
Good night.